Last night we spoke about one small select group of Christians who are part of our heritage. Those were the Anabaptists. And we said that one of the reasons we remember them and we need to reflect on their lives is because of the wonderful examples they provided for us of courage and of paying an ultimate price for your faith. Today we want to look at another group of people from history. This time very famous people. I'd venture to say most of you had not heard of those folks last night. You will have heard of all of these. We want to remember them and reflect on their lives and imitate them also. But there's a little different twist to their stories. Martin Luther was born in a small East German town in 1483. No one had any reason to think when that little baby boy showed up that he would turn out to be one of the most significant people who's ever lived. By the time he died in 1546, he would have emerged as the one we know as the father of the Protestant Reformation. He would have emerged as a great scholar, man of great courage, one who stood alone not just against the residual power of the medieval Roman Catholic Church, but against the power of the Holy Roman Empire. He was both excommunicated and condemned, lived his life as an outlaw. His biblical translation changed the course not only of German faith, but of the German language. His catechetical writings and his hymns, for instance, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," have far outlived him. He provided the pattern not just for Protestant church, but for such things as the Protestant parish and all of that. And a tremendous man of faith. One of the great privileges of my life during October of 1999 was to stand at Luther's grave in the cathedral in Wittenberg and just reflect on his life and give thanks for him. But you know, if that's the only thing, if those were the only things we knew about Martin Luther, we would have an incorrect and an incomplete look at Martin Luther. Because Martin Luther could also be a very difficult person. He could be extremely overbearing. You basically either agreed with Luther or you were wrong. Had a slashingly sarcastic tongue to the point of being cruel. For instance, one day a gentleman came to see him who was really looking for unity. He and Luther were in two separate camps, and this guy named Schwenkfelter came to see Luther and was hoping they could work out some things, and he came in basically flying a flag of truce and looking for fellowship. And Luther began to refer to him as Schweinfelter. The word we know is swine. And for the rest of that guy's life, Luther would speak of him derisively as Schweinfelter. There was no call for that. When the Peasants' War broke out in 1525, which was a disaster, those were the folks who had supported Luther. For a number of reasons that I don't have time to go into, Luther turned against them and he wrote a charming little tract called "Against the Murdering Hordes of Peasants," appealing to the troops to slaughter them. That's exactly what they did. But probably one of the saddest things in Martin Luther's life was his decided anti-Semitism. And in the last decades of his life, that was so obvious. His writings, he continued to drift further and further, until it was really nothing but just a vitriolic attack on Judaism. And unfortunately, throughout the last 400 years of history, there would be those like Adolf Hitler who would use Martin Luther's writings and would say, you see, even the great theologians understood what we ought to do to the Jews. And you look at that life and you think, Martin, how in the world could you do that? How could you be the great man of faith and the great wonderful reformer who stood against everybody and he said, God help me, I can do nothing else, here I stand. You think, how could you be those other ways? Well, about the time Martin Luther was being born in Eastern Germany, Queen Isabella was coming to power in Spain. Now, history remembers Isabella mainly because she became the patron and the financier of Christopher Columbus' voyages. Had it not been for her, we probably would never have heard of Christopher Columbus. But much more than that, Queen Isabella was a devout believer, a devout Roman Catholic believer. She took her faith very, very seriously. She wanted God honored. She wanted the church cleaned up. And during her years of reign, she followed an aggressive period of reform earlier, you know, decades before Martin Luther started reforming. She built universities for the training of clergy. She worked on reforming the priests morally and ethically. She was the patron for biblical translations. Out of some of her work would come ultimately the university that the Jesuits would arise. One of the great missionary arms in the history of the church. She's a great, devout woman of faith. But if that's all we knew about Isabella, we would have an incorrect look. In her zeal to perfect the faith and in her zeal to protect the faith, she re-energized the ancient Inquisition. And with people that were under her rule basically doing the work, they began to persecute in a hostile fashion Muslims and Jews, and then, of course, Christians. Now, while the stated purpose of the Inquisition was to call people to genuine faith, the end result was the end result of all kinds of religious persecution, which was the suffering of people. People were tortured. They were put to death. Incredible stories coming out of the Spanish Inquisition. And we look at that and we think, Isabella, how could you do that? How could somebody who loved God and who loved the Bible so much and who wanted the church to be so clean and so pure and what God wanted it to be, and somebody who was a patron of education, and how could you do that? One of the great figures of the 18th century in England was named John Wesley. Wesley was born in 1703 and died in 1791, so he had a long life. And John and his brother Charles, as much as anybody else, were responsible for the evangelical revival in England that took place during much of the 18th century. John Wesley was a great man, very profound believer, great scholar, indefatigable worker. I mean, the amount of work the guy could turn out was incredible. Wonderful organizer. That's why his group began to be called the Methodists, because of Wesley's methods. And he knew how to organize small groups and how to teach and train leaders. And wonderful preacher of the gospel, incredible writer. I mean, John Wesley, his brother Charles, had an enormous impact. Still do. But if that's all we knew about John Wesley, we would have an incomplete picture. Just speak of one area in his life. Wesley was apparently an abject failure when it came to relationships, especially relationships with the other sex. Some of you should be encouraged. When Wesley went to Georgia, when Georgia was a colony in the 1720s, he fell very much in love with a dear young lady who was really, I think, the great love of his life. Probably should have married her. But for a number of reasons, the relationship went south, mainly his fault. And he graciously excommunicated her. That means he used his religious privilege and withdrew from her the right of fellowship in the church. Real advantage if you happen to be a clergyman, you can do that kind of stuff, I guess. Well, he went back to England and started what would be his dynamic work there, and it was such a blessed work in so many ways. Along the line, developed a relationship with another woman, Probably should have married her, but he didn't. She married somebody else. And I read a letter that Wesley wrote to her husband, and he's trying his best to be decent, but he basically ends up denouncing them for their betrayal of him and everything. And the sad thing about it is it's everybody else's fault. And when you read those letters, you look for some hint that maybe he would take some credit there, but you don't see it. And then when he was an older man, he finally married. And he was married for 30 years. And his marriage was signally unhappy. Really desperately unhappy. Wesley traveled a great deal anyway, and I have to think that in his later years, one of the reasons he traveled, he did not want to be around his wife. But again, we see in his correspondence to her, I think, a rather heavy-handed, high-handed approach and a very spiritual-sounding approach. And I guess I would have felt so much better if somewhere in one of those letters he would have suggested, maybe I haven't always been everything I should have been either. But you never read that. It's always, he always did everything. He was following God. And you want to say, John, give it a rest. He didn't even know of her death. He came riding back into London on one of his trips and somebody told him his wife had died. And you think, Wesley, how could you do that? How could you be such a great man? How could you have been used so magnificently of God and have accomplished so much and yet have such a glaring hole in your life? William Carey is considered by most, and I think legitimately so, the father of Protestant missions. In 1792, when he and his family sailed for Calcutta, India, it would signal the beginning of the modern Protestant missions movement. And Carey served in India for almost 40 years. Actually, for 40 years. When I stood at his grave in a little unkempt cemetery in Serampore, right outside Calcutta, in 1987, and stood and just reflected on the life of that little Englishman and all that he did, it was a profound moment for me, thanking God for his life and for his incredible years of labor and his biblical scholarship and his translation of the Bible into like 16 or 17 different languages, and his teaching and his training and his work as a botanist and his social justice work. The guy was incredible. And I stood there and was just in awe that one little guy could be used that much. But you know, if that's all we knew about William Carey, we'd have an incomplete picture. You see, when William Carey got ready to go to India, his wife did not want to go. In fact, she pled with him not to go. See, she hadn't married a foreign missionary. She had married a cobbler and a Baptist pastor. She did not want to go. She had already begun to show signs of emotional instability, maybe even the first signs of mental illness. And she did not want to go. Only decided to go about a day or two before the ship left. Well, the trip over was miserable for her. And when they finally got to India, the Indian experience was a tragic one for her. Her health continued to decline, and in her latter years, she was insane. And she lived out the latter years of her life in a little room on the Serampore Mission compound where Carey worked. When I was there in 87, and somebody pointed up to that second floor room, and they said that's where Mrs. Carey was confined and died. And you think about that, and you think, William, how could you do that? How dare you do that? How dare you take your wife, who did not want to go and who pled with you not to go? How dare you do that? How dare you condemn her to an unhappy life like that, and ultimately to a destroyed life? Well, how do we deal with those kind of stories? I'm not sure I know. But let me make three suggestions to you. Things that I think about as an historian when I read the lives of the men and women of the faith. First of all, a little word of balance. We need to be a bit careful judging those of other centuries and of other generations. We cannot go with 21st century eyes to the 15th century and the 16th century and the 19th century and automatically plop down our standards on them because they didn't necessarily see things the same. The world was not the same. So, to begin with, we need to back off just a little bit. But secondly, I think one of the things that we need to grasp is the one characteristic thread that runs through all human beings, believers or not, is that we are sinners. And while at our best, we can be pretty impressive, at our worst, we can be pretty despicable. And that is true of all of us. The fact of the matter is, men and women, there is none of us who is the follower of Jesus Christ that he or she should be. And there is certainly none of us that is the follower of Christ that he or she talks about being. None of us is as spiritual as other people think we are. You know, we are sinners and we struggle. And when we read the lives of these men and women who have gone before us, what we see is that very same characteristic in them. They were imperfect people. They were flawed people. Sometimes flawed terribly. Third thing. The only kind of people that I've been able to find in history that God used were people just like that. Flawed people. People who were not completely consistent. People who sometimes struggled with terrible things and often failed miserably. And yet we can see God using those kinds of people. Now see, that ought to be encouraging to you. It is to me, because what that says is if God can use those kinds of people, then God may be able to use you. And he may be able to use me. Now, while that's certainly not an excuse to be anything less than as committed as we can be, it ought to be at least a little bit encouraging that God has no perfect saints. You know, in the divine draft, God got no blue chip players. I suppose from an Oklahoma colloquial standpoint, we would say God got maybe cow chip players. God got sinners. That's all God got. And you can dress us up and clean us up and educate us and culture us, but all you've got is dressed up, cleaned up, educated, cultured sinners. And yet God uses those kinds of people. So when you go roaming around on your campus there at the University of Oklahoma, up and down the South Oval, or, you know, sitting in the football stadium or hanging around the BSU or whatever, and you wonder, you know what, I'm about a half a yard ahead of a total spiritual collapse. Is it possible God could use me? Well, be encouraged. God could. And I think I'd be even bolder than that. God will. So these leaders, we want to remember them. We want to reflect on their lives, and we want to imitate their faith by drawing strength, not just from their great victories, which they had, but also from their great defeats. Because that's pretty much going to characterize us. Go in peace.